This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, figuring out whether a thunderstorm is going to produce big hail or a major tornado may have gotten a little easier, and we've got a UW-Madison scientist to thank for it. We'll talk to the researcher behind that discovery coming up. Now, former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish announced last week that she was officially entering the race to become Wisconsin's governor in 2022. She's the highest-profile Republican in the campaign so far. A businessman named Jonathan Wickman has filed papers in that primary. Other candidates are expected to join the race. We're talking now about the 2022 Wisconsin race for governor, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What issues are important to you? What credentials are important to you in a governor? Do you have thoughts on Governor Evers and his reelection efforts and now Rebecca Clayfish's candidacy? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the co-author of several books, including Mad Men in Politics, Nostalgia, and the Remaking of Modern America. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on today, Rob.
Well, I'll start off with an important asterisk. It's early. A lot could change between now and actual voting. But that said, Wisconsin statewide races tend to be close. Are we expecting lots and lots of national attention on this race here in the state?
Well, I think that the race in Wisconsin for the governor's office is perhaps not the highest profile race, that statewide race that Wisconsin will see, which I think is probably going to be the senator's race. But I think it will be a close second, in part because I think a lot is going to potentially depend on who is in the governor's office and the makeup of the state legislature coming out of 2022 and into 2024. And so I think that it will probably be quite a high-profile race, and probably there will be a lot of national attention.
And now we have former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish as the first big name candidate. Bill McCoshin, as we just heard in the news, was floating the idea of a race. He's not jumping in. There's other names out there. Can you talk about Lieutenant Governor Clayfish as a candidate, obviously involved with the Walker two terms as governor and everything that came out of that? Your thoughts on her as a possible Republican contender?
Well, I mean, she has won a statewide race a couple of times, and including the recall effort. And so she does have that as a credential, not only in terms of who she is within the Republican Party, but the fact that she has run and won statewide race, which is, distinct from other people who have been in assembly districts or statehouse districts and may not have run for a statewide race, or people who are in business who may not have the same kind of political profile that Rebecca Clayfish had as Scott Walker's lieutenant governor for 8 years.
I want to give a listen to Rebecca Clayfish speaking here in her announcement last week. Here's a listen.
And today I announce to you that he may shut down our schools. He may shut down our economy. He may shut down our churches. But today we begin to shut down Tony Evers.
Referring there to early pandemic efforts. Now, we just came out of this election in California, this recall that fell short and shutdown efforts, and the pandemic played big roles there. They were the main line of attack against Governor there, Gavin Newsom. Another asterisk, Wisconsin is not California, but can we learn anything from that effort that appeared to fall short in California?
Well, and again, this is a recall effort in California, and right. So that's a big asterisk there in terms of sort of the regular cycle of elections and having an effort made to recall a sitting governor in California, where they were successful some years back with the election of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and they have had regular recalls of other people because they do a lot of recalling apparently in California. We have seen the recall in Wisconsin, but not nearly as much. And so I think that, you do have the issue of the pandemic as something that is relevant in a lot of different states, because many states have different approaches and have taken different approaches along the way, and that Governor Evers has also taken approaches that have been at odds with the state house, the legislature, which is in Republican hands, and so that there's been a lot of tension also with regard to various policies around response to the pandemic. And so I have a feeling that the pandemic is likely to be an issue during the primary. Again, the election is more than a year out, the general election, and we don't exactly know what the status of our health with regard to COVID-19 will be in Wisconsin or other states. So it may be less of an issue at the point of the election next November.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University in Waukesha, previewing the race for governor here in Wisconsin in 2022. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is important to you in this race? What issues do you see as being really at stake in the choice of a governor of Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Owen is with us in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call, Rob. Yeah, my biggest concern is if we go completely Republican, on across the spectrum here, we got Robin Voss, Scott Fitzgerald, and then we got Rebecca Clayfish as the incumbent or the challenger or whatever. So we... what are we going to do? We're going to create a whole bunch of laws that a lot of the more liberal folks in the state couldn't deal with as a result. But if we have a balance of power where we have Scott Fitzgerald, Robin Voss in control of the House and the Senate, then we would have a Democratic governor that could veto that. That would probably be all right. But the problem is we have gridlock like we have now. And I just would encourage any constituents to write letters, because I don't think that our politicians actually listen or even are tuned into this radio program right now. I think that they're in their own world and they don't really care about what other people think. They're working for themselves.
Owen, thanks a lot for the call. And just Scott Fitzgerald has moved on to Congress now, but point taken, Republican control of the legislature, divided government there. I want to start, Lily, with Owen's last point. Feeling a disconnect with politicians of all parties, feeling like they're not representing people. That's something we hear from callers fairly often here. Is that something that's just generally out there in the American public, this, I don't know, like feeling that politicians of any party don't represent them?
Well, I think that, you know, this has long been a complaint that politicians are disconnected from the people that they represent, particularly the ones we, quote, send to Washington because they're so far away from us. And that was something, you know, you can go back to the founding and have that as a concern that people had. At the same time, you know, when you're sort of electing people and sending them to the state house, they're generally not as, quote, far away from you. But they may be at this point, because of partisan polarization, they may be more interested in listening to what the parties are telling them to do than what their constituents are telling them to do. And that's, I think, where a lot of people feel like there is a disconnect between the people that they elect or vote for and what those people do when they're in office.
Thanks for the call, Owen. Owen also brings up a likely choice of outcomes, either full Republican control if a Republican is elected and if Republicans keep control of the legislature, or our current state of affairs with divided government where there's checks and balances, but as Owen pointed out, gridlock. I don't know. What do you think of voters comparing those two alternatives?
Well, I mean, I think that it's very much the case that we have certainly seen over the last couple of years of the Evers administration is that he has been confronted by a legislature that is very much opposed to a lot of what he's trying to do, and he's opposed to what the legislature is trying to do. So instead of necessarily having, you know, sort of a nebulous kind of divided government, we do end up in this kind of gridlock situation. And Evers has used the veto a lot, which is something that governors and presidents do often when they're faced with a legislature that is passing legislation that they don't support.
We're talking to Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University, previewing the 2022 Wisconsin governor's race. Governor Tony Evers running for re-election. Former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, the big name so far in the Republican field in the race. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a Republican, is there somebody you want to see run that hasn't announced a candidacy yet? Whatever party you are or aren't, what are the most important things for you when you're thinking about who you want to be the next governor of Wisconsin? Do you have thoughts, hopes on ways Wisconsin government could work better, regardless of who the governor is? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Carroll University political science professor Lily Gorin about how the 2022 race for Wisconsin governor is shaping up. You can join in with your thoughts. 800-642-1234 is the number. What issues have you worried and or excited about this upcoming campaign for governor here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to our callers now. Sally is with us in Medford. Sally, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And I just agree so much with your guest when she said that voters are really tired of partisan gridlock. Because of that, me and my husband are determined that we're going to vote for an independent candidate. We already have somebody we're backing. We believe is strong and decent candidate. But his biggest contribution, honestly, is that he's neither Republican nor Democrat. He's independent. And we believe we absolutely have to break this system because it's killing our state and it's killing our country. And we believe that's the only way forward.
Sally, thanks for the call. Sally, frustrated with the two-party system. Lily, looking for outside alternatives. It's a tall order, though. We've had independent campaigns for governor here in Wisconsin that didn't end up getting a lot of votes.
That's true, although our neighbors to the north have had more successful independent campaigns for governor in the election of Jesse Ventura about 20 years ago. And, of course, Wisconsin about 100 years ago elected third-party candidates to office. But you are absolutely right that third-party candidates, particularly these days in Wisconsin, we don't have a lot of mechanisms for a lot of traction for third-party candidates, but that doesn't mean that they should be ruled out.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sally. I think people look back sometimes to the era when Tommy Thompson was the Republican governor of Wisconsin. Democrats controlled the legislature, and, they didn't hug each other all the time, but they passed stuff. They made bargains. They dealt with each other. Is that just sort of golden age thinking, or has something really changed where that partisan divide doesn't allow that kind of cooperation?
The partisan divide these days is so acute, and you see this not only in Wisconsin, but you see it at the national level as well, that there's often little room for cooperation. And in part, that's oftentimes the case because one party doesn't want to give a, quote, win to the other party. And so you see this on both sides of the aisle, but it tends to be asymmetric in terms of less cooperation, oftentimes, this is not exclusive, with regard to Republicans not wanting to give a win to a Democrat. And so there is that part of the equation that we don't have the same kind of sort of cooperation across the board in bipartisan ways that we used to have, although the halcyon nature of those sort of memories are not always as halcyon as people sometimes make them out to be.
Yeah, I don't think at the time anybody thought they were in a golden age of happiness and cooperation.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Marie is with us in Dodgeville. Marie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Marie?
Gerrymandering. I'm really concerned about it. I think that's the biggest reason that we feel that our politicians are not really representing us, because we have one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. And the lines have been drawn to rig the system, and it's in favor of one-party rule. It decreases competition. It muffles the voices of citizens who are in the minority. We don't get equal representation. We end up with hyper-partisanship. And so as the lines are being redrawn now because of the census having happened, maybe we can start to have fair maps for a change. If the People's Map Commission gets their way, gets to be heard, instead of having a secret map drawing session with just a few Republican figures.
Marie, thanks a lot for the call. This will affect, of course, the race for the state legislature coming up in 2022 at the same time as the governor's race we're talking about. A hot issue now. Lily, your thoughts on redistricting and gerrymandering?
Well, I mean, this is absolutely one of the reasons why the polarization tends to be more acute, is because oftentimes the districts that are drawn are so safe that the politician who gets elected from them doesn't have to listen to the people who are in the minority who didn't vote for that person, because they have no need to have to depend on those votes in any way. And as a result of that, you do end up with, you know, sort of people really entrenched in their positions, in their partisan positions, and to some degree often unwilling to make any kind of compromise because they don't have to.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Lily, for the race for governor and for U.S. Senate, you mentioned that race as well. It's not gerrymandering. It's a district the size of Wisconsin. But you'd think it's such an evenly divided state, or you might think that that would make candidates run toward the middle to pick off enough votes on their side. But we have a really liberal U.S. senator, a really conservative U.S. senator. Our governor candidates don't seem to run toward the middle. Why not?
Well, I mean, I think while we are sort of an evenly divided state, the politics in Wisconsin is hardly purple. There are red parts of the state and blue parts of the state. And I think that's one of the reasons why the candidates, particularly for statewide race, often run and try to, you know, get their supporters out so that whoever is the Republican or the Democrat tries to get more of their own supporters out, as opposed to trying to work across and pull people from the other party to support them. And that's been the case for a while now.
Wanted to actually, let's go back to our callers. Ann is with us in Wausau. Ann, hi.
Yes, I just wanted to call and say that I'm a huge proponent of term limits, because I think what's happening in our country is people are in office too long, and it becomes that they're developing way too much power, or it becomes a power struggle versus them serving the constituents that they represent and then going back on their, you know, going back to their lives.
And thanks a lot for the call. And some states, I know, Lily, do have term limits for the governor. We do not here in Wisconsin. What's the political science thinking on the impact of term limits?
Well, I mean, at the national level, it's a much more difficult conversation because it would have to be a constitutional amendment. But at the state level, you can have term limits for governors, and you could potentially have them also for state elected officials in the assembly as well. And, you know, it sort of varies from state to state. One of the oddest states with regard to term limits is Virginia, which only lets you be governor for one term. They have their election on odd cycles, so they are having a governor's race this coming year. And in that context as well, you can run again, but you can't run again immediately. And so you're one and done, as they call it in Virginia. And so you're there and you do the work, and then that's it. You have 4 years to accomplish what you want to accomplish. Other states have a couple, you know, you can be governor for a couple of terms. We have that at the presidential level as well. There are pluses and minuses in terms of the learning curve and implementing an agenda, and then also leaving office without being there for very long time.
In our last couple minutes, Lily, I want to bring up a wild card issue, abortion. A lot of lawsuits, the Texas law, a Mississippi court case headed to the Supreme Court. If Roe versus Wade is limited or overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, it becomes a huge issue in states like Wisconsin with some laws on the books. What are your thoughts on that and how it could play out in this election?
Well, I think, and we saw a little bit of this in the California recall election, and I have a feeling we're going to see more of it in state elections as they unfold, is that that abortion, if Roe versus Wade is overturned by the Supreme Court, or if there are more efforts like SB8 in Texas, the states implement severely limiting access to abortion rights, and rights under the right to privacy, that this is actually going to become an issue that state candidates are going to be campaigning on, because it may devolve to the state directly and immediately with regard to abortion rights and elimination of access to abortion in states as well.
We'll leave it there. Lily, thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Sorry about the dog barking.
Well, I didn't even hear it. We love to meet dogs on this show. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She joined us for a look at the race for governor of Wisconsin. You can follow all the news as it develops at WPR.org. Our news team will bring you developments as they continue, and a lot more news, of course, to come in 2022. Coming up, large hail and violent tornadoes can be hard to predict even in the midst of big thunderstorms, but scientists may have figured out a new clue. A UW researcher shares that discovery. You can follow all these conversations on the Ideas Network anytime, anywhere. Stream us, WPR.org, or go through and find lots and lots of great archive conversations, or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll check out new research in Wisconsin on the possible medical uses of psychedelic substances. Now, with a lot of different factors at play, weather forecasting can be a pretty difficult job. And we're not just talking about whether it's going to rain 3 or 4 days out. Try predicting what a thunderstorm is going to do over the next hour. Some new research is giving scientists hope when it comes to severe weather, particularly the formation of large hail and violent tornadoes. They also help answer some questions about climate change. Lee Orff is an associate scientist with the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's an expert on severe thunderstorms, tornadoes, and using supercomputers to simulate the atmosphere. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of how difficult it is to predict what a violent thunderstorm is going to do next?
Yeah, it's a real problem. And as you know, the National Weather Service will often issue a warning when a thunderstorm looks like it's going to produce, say, damaging tornadoes or hail, or maybe it's already been observed to do so. But even though we know that sometimes those warnings, a tornado doesn't form, or the thunderstorm maybe dissipates, or something happens that we don't expect. And the reason for this, our inability to predict the storms, is that it's a really hard problem. We are becoming more and more reliant on computer models to simulate the future state of the atmosphere, but those models are only as good as the data that you feed them. And, radar and satellite and surface observations all go into making those model forecasts, but they're still not accurate enough because we just don't have an observational network mesh that's fine scale enough to initialize these models, and because the models themselves need improvements. But yeah, it's a very difficult problem. It just is.
Well, you've found one clue now, a link between a type of cloud above the storm and imminent severe weather. What did you find?
So a feature that was, it's been identified for years observationally, but recently was given a name called an above anvil cirrus plume. And some other scientists identified these features from satellite imagery primarily. And it turns out, it looks like if you look at one of these things from space, you know, the top of a thunderstorm is flat like a pancake. And the above anvil cirrus plume, as its name implies, rises above that anvil, kind of like a mohawk haircut. You know, think of a little ridge that sort of sticks up on top of that anvil. And it turns out that 75% or so of thunderstorms that exhibit these plumes are either producing large hail or tornadoes. So this is a really tantalizingly important factor that could possibly be used to issue more accurate forecasts in the case of severe weather. However, the actual physical mechanism by which these plumes are telling us something about what's going on near the ground, we don't know what that link is. And our research is like a first step, I think, at really identifying that link.
Do we know even what's creating that that anvil plume sticking up above the thunder clouds?
Why, yes, we do. And in fact, that's what our research discovered. What makes this research significant enough to make it into Science magazine, which, you know, is a pretty big deal for a scientist, is that this, we identified something called a hydraulic jump, which is a well-known feature. It's been known for hundreds of years, that is usually associated with water flowing through a channel, or say water flowing through a channel where it's very smooth and it suddenly just decomposes into this frothy mixture of wave activity. That is a hydraulic jump. When you have fluid moving too fast, you have what's called supercritical flow. And when you have supercritical flow, it just bursts into turbulence. And that's exactly what's happening at the top of our thunderstorms. So instead of a mountain, which is where we've seen these hydraulic jump flows in the atmosphere before, we don't have an actual mountain or any topography in our simulation. We just have a thunderstorm. So the wind is actually flowing over the top of the thunderstorm as if the top of the thunderstorm is a mountain, and then plunging down that cloud mountain and reaching that screamingly fast velocity, where it then reaches supercritical velocity, a hydraulic jump forms, and then you have moisture from the troposphere, that's the layer of the atmosphere which we all inhabit, that's being churned into the stratosphere, which is the stable layer above us, which contains all the ozone, by the way, but it also is sort of a lid to the troposphere. It sort of pushes back. And we're now jamming a bunch of water into the stratosphere with these thunderstorms. And we've actually quantified that number pretty well. And that's one of the things we're going to be looking into. And if I may say one more thing about why this is important, water vapor in the stratosphere can be dissociated and it can actually lead to ozone destruction. So water vapor in the stratosphere plays a role in the ozone process of formation and destruction. And as we understand it, too much water vapor in the stratosphere is generally not considered a good thing. And with climate changing and thunderstorms potentially getting more and stronger, there's a potential that there's a feedback mechanism that we may that may be in existence here. But it's a little early days for that.
Talking to Lee Orff, scientist at UW-Madison, looking at a discovery that he has published in Science magazine with his colleagues, looking at a clue to which thunderstorms might be particularly violent, large hail, tornadoes, and that sort of thing. Lee, are we at a point here? Are we close to a point where the National Weather Service is going to look for this plume and that's going to affect their decision to issue a watch or a warning?
I won't speak for them. I am doing research with, I am collaborating with some folks who are more along the operational areas. And believe me when I say this, the Weather Service, we're all desperate for any kind of clues that can help us when it comes to forecasting tornadoes, which are very, very difficult to forecast. So I don't know exactly how it works in their workflow right now, but I do know that they know that if 3 out of 4 storms exhibiting plumes are known to produce hail and or tornadoes, then it's probably a storm to keep an eye on.
So these plumes are pretty big and striking, and a lot of people are thinking about, you know, what makes a dangerous storm. Why didn't we know about this phenomenon already?
Great question. Well, there's a couple of reasons. If you take it from the perspective of the modeling side of things, which is what I do, in order for this feature, this hydraulic jet, to actually exist, you have to use a supercomputer. You need to run at very high resolution. So you need to dedicate an awful lot of resources to breaking up the atmosphere into tiny little cubes and spreading those cubes evenly all around through the domain. What's typically done in order to save time and computational resources is that meteorologists will use what's called a stretched grid, where the resolution is focused near the ground where all the hail and the tornadoes and all the humans are, and they sort of relax the grid and make it more coarse as you go to the top of the cloud. So you simply cannot resolve these things unless you really throw a lot of computational resources at it. So the next step, of course, is to go out in an airplane, a research aircraft with a radar on it, and go see if we can detect these things. And I'm confident that we will. And I know that there are some field programs that are going on now that are going to be very interested in this research result. And I suspect that it will guide them in future attempts to actually observe this feature in the atmosphere, because in meteorology, if you don't see it in the atmosphere, it doesn't exist. You know, you can see it in the model, and the models are hugely important to guide us in our understanding of the atmosphere. But until it's found in the real atmosphere, this will still be, you know, something that is, it's important, and it's going to be, I'm certain it exists because of the nature of this kind of flow. It's not too controversial.
Okay, Lee, you use computers to simulate these violent storms. And as you're saying, you need the best data possible from the real world. But it seems like the most useful data would be coming from smack in the middle of these dangerous storms, which seems like a hard place to gather lots of useful data, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and this is why you're really hitting on, in meteorology, there's observational components where people actually go out with instrumentation, they launch balloons, they bring their radars on trucks, they get as close to the storm as they can. It's very dangerous. Lightning is very dangerous. It's very hard to fly into these storms. You have updrafts that are, you know, 100 miles an hour. You just can't hit one of those in an airplane and not expect to have a bad day. So, I mean, there are aircraft that are designed to fly in hail and such, but that's difficult research. So in situ or getting into the storm, it's very dangerous. Remote sensing techniques are useful, but I'm on the safe side of things. I'm over here in model land where all I do is deal with computer bugs instead of having to deal with the dangerous field work, or at least potentially dangerous field work.
Lee, thanks.
Go ahead.
Go ahead and finish that thought.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in meteorology, you've got the observational aspect, the computational aspect, which is kind of where I inhabit, and then the theoretical aspect where you're sort of figuring things out with equations and physics. So in the case of above Anvil cirrus plumes, no one had really hypothesized that they existed in the first place above the thunderstorms that I'm aware of. Nobody had modeled them before, and they hadn't been seen in the atmosphere above a thunderstorm. So we now have the modeling component. Next, we'll see the observational component, and we're sort of working on the theoretical component as well.
Lee, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to do it. Take care, Rob.
You too. That's Lee Orff, Associate Scientist with the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. Talk to him about his new research into supercell thunderstorms that could help predict whether they'll produce large hail and violent tornadoes. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This year marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's producer Maureen McCollum sharing a story about siblings, part of a project that allowed high school students to tell their own stories on Wisconsin Life called Classroom Frequency.
Earlier this year, I started working with students at Monona Grove Liberal Arts Charter School, or MG21. The goal was to get more high school students' stories on the airwaves. When I first showed up in the classroom, there was one student who seemed to be particularly interested in creating radio and interviewing people.
Like, I'm always that person that I always keep, like, asking questions. Like, it's uncomfortable for me to be quiet and uncomfortable for me to not have a conversation, so my brain is always running.
Junior Sierra Reederer had like 4 story ideas on day one, which is impressive. Stories about school lockdowns and charter schools. Ultimately, Sierra decided to work on a story about her brother, 13-year-old Thomas. I went to her house one night as Sierra was teaching Thomas how to play pool.
Wanna grab your stick, bub?
Yes.
Oh, shoot.
What other games do you like to play?
We like playing Minecraft. Do you like watching movies?
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing to eat?
Gosh, your fried root beer.
Grilled cheese, fries, and what?
Root beer.
I decided to do my brother because I love him. My brother has Down syndrome, and how that affects like our family, and how he's not really different from like anyone else, but at the same time he is. I don't know, my brother's just an interesting person, so I was like, why not do the interesting person in my life?
Sierra then went on to interview her mom and grandma about Thomas. Let's listen to parts of those conversations.
I'm Sierra Reeder, and I'm here sitting with Shirley Drew and my grandma at her house in her kitchen, and we're gonna talk about my little brother Thomas and how his Down syndrome has affected him or not affected him, and just a little bit about him. So to start off, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Great, okay. Do you remember the feelings you had when you were told that Thomas had Down syndrome?
I probably didn't have any real feelings. I just thought, okay, what can we do for him to make his life better?
What are some of the best memories that you've had with Thomas?
When we're in the car, and he puts in the CD, and right now, today, it's Johnny Mathis, a Christmas CD.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
And we sing these songs each time he gets in the car, 365 days out of the year. I love it.
Why do you love Thomas so much?
He's made my life fuller, and he's never angry. Doesn't matter what, generally he does not hold a grudge. For that reason alone, I love him.
I'm Sierra Reeder, and I'm here with my mom, Michelle Reeder, in our office, and I'm going to interview her about some questions about my little brother, Thomas. Why do you love Thomas so much, besides from the fact that he's your own kid?
You know, he just brings another spin on life. You know, when you're not having those good days, then he kind of can turn it around sometimes.
What challenges come with having a child with Down syndrome? Sorry, I didn't mean to make you cry.
Not knowing what the future holds for him. You know, making sure everything is in place, you know, when he gets to be to the point of independence. So when the day comes that we're not here anymore, he can still navigate the world.
I told him if he ever wants to come live with me, he has me.
That was MG21 Junior, Sierra Reederer, talking with her family about her brother Thomas. To hear her full interviews, check out our hour-long special, Classroom Frequency, Student Stories from Wisconsin, or visit wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, UW-Madison has launched a new research center to coordinate ongoing research and education in psychedelic compounds. The founding director tells us what they hope to accomplish. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. UW-Madison researchers are investigating possible uses of psychedelic compounds, and that effort has gotten a new boost with the creation of a new research center. The center, called the Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances, will conduct scholarly research into the science, history, and cultural impact of psychedelic agents, as well as studying their possible role in treating substance abuse and psychiatric disorders. Paul Hudson is director of the new UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances, also a professor in the UW School of Pharmacy. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be here.
Well, this new central location for research is new, but research has been going on here at UW for quite some time. We've talked to you about it in the past. Could you talk about the range of research already happening here?
Well, thank you. Yes, we've been working in this space for about 7 years now. We did the first in the country dose escalation study with psilocybin, looked at higher doses and the safety of those, and basically set up the dosage that people around the country and frankly around the world are using now, which is a major accomplishment there too. But we have other studies that are going on, both that are sponsored by various companies, but also investigator-initiated studies focusing at this point primarily on depression, PTSD, and substances of abuse.
What kind of promise do different psychedelic substances show for some of these, especially mental health-related conditions?
Some of these mental health conditions seem to be responding extremely well to some individuals. Not everybody. It's not a panacea. But the initial results for patients with substance use disorders seem to have a remarkable benefit from a few doses. In depression, a single dose of psilocybin seems to have a durable effect in many people for 6 months, even a year. And then for PTSD, the use of the addition of MDMA, also referred to as ecstasy, seems to have almost a six-fold benefit in terms of remission of PTSD that lasts for months and maybe even longer. So the effects in some individuals that are responding are really quite remarkable.
Now, this is unique in some ways, given that these are things that are illegal for people to just buy and sell on the street. Does that affect things like getting permissions to do this kind of research?
There are more hurdles to jump over to get to the point where we can do this research. But once those hurdles have been passed by, it is legal to do this research. The FDA doesn't prohibit its use if we go through those particular hoops. And in fact, quite honestly, speaking informally with people from the FDA and the DEA, they're rather excited about this work themselves, and they just want us to see it being done right.
I understand part of your work at the center includes trying to be more inclusive with underserved and underrepresented populations, especially when it comes to things like these clinical trials. Can you talk about that?
It's a major deficiency of the studies that have been done so far, not to the fault of the investigators, but the studies that have been so remarkable in their results typically do not have a large number of blacks in particular and other minorities. And that, I think, has to do with not only the suspicion of medical research in general among some of these populations, but the fact that these treatments are rather complicated in terms of the number of visits required, the duration of the treatment day of a full day. And so we're trying to address that and asking the community to help us understand what we can do to make it more available. If these drugs are as effective as we think they may be in some individuals, then it would really be a shame for the minority communities and the underserved communities, rural as well, to not have access to the same thing that others are accessing.
Now, these are substances in many cases that have been used not under clinical conditions for a long time, whether in some cases by indigenous groups for ritual purposes, recreationally, of course, in the U.S. Are you able to glean usable information, even though those weren't done in controlled lab situations?
Well, I think one of the most important components about these traditional uses, especially in indigenous cultures, both in South America, Latin America, in Central America, and even in the North American communities, there is a ceremony associated with this. There is a preparation. There is something that is somewhat sacred about it. So rather than just rather reckless recreational use of these products, we are really trying to create a process and, in a sense, a ceremony that is also important, not only for efficacy, but also for safety.
Do you have a timeline in mind for the FDA saying, yes, we're giving approval for these psychedelic substances to be used in these conditions and prescribed?
You know, we've finished a second of two major registration trials with MDMA for the treatment of PTSD recently. And I think that the sponsoring organization, MAPS, is probably going to be going to the FDA within the next year and a half. I would not be surprised to see that MDMA is approved for the treatment of PTSD by 2023, maybe 24 at the latest, and psilocybin maybe a year or two after that. So I think within 5 years, we're going to be seeing the FDA accepting these drugs. They're already been given breakthrough drug designation by the FDA. So in 5 years, we're going to have to figure out a way to make it more accessible to people that currently don't have access to this kind of research and in the future of the treatment.
In our last minute or so, do you have hopes that bringing together people under one roof, metaphorically, maybe the Transdisciplinary Center, is going to spark new innovations?
I think it will. We've already been approached by several companies that have really some novel ideas about what to be bringing to new research, new compounds, but also new indications. And so I think that by bringing the center together on the University of campus, we're going to be bringing in scholars, we're going to be bringing in inventors, but hopefully also we're going to be able to figure out a way to get it out there to the community. It's the Wisconsin idea, and it's the right thing to do.
We'll leave it there, Paul. Thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Rob. Take care.
That's Paul Hudson, director of the new UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. He's a professor in the UW School of Pharmacy. He joined us to talk about what impact the newly formed center will have on their future research and education and possible therapies of the future. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, hear the story of groundbreaking women in journalism who worked as war correspondents with the author of the new book, You Don't Belong Here. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at the results from last night's attempted recall of California Governor Gavin Newsom, plus a look at the latest stumbling blocks in the effort to pass infrastructure bills in Congress. That and more in our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Follow these conversations each day, every day at WPR.org. Stream or consult the archives there, or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to follow along. And if you ever have thoughts on what you hear on Central Time, let us know on Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.